Welcome to the Black Sox Scandal Committee meeting. My name is Jacob Pomeranke, and beside me is David Fletcher, who's a longtime Sabre member and founder of the Chicago Baseball Museum. I'm the chair of the Black Sox Scandal Committee and also do a few other things around here for Sabre. I know some of you have to head out for the bus tour soon, so we're going to get to the fun stuff now before a few of you have to leave. And then we'll take some questions. We also have some books available in the vendor's room, and we'll be over there after this panel is over to sign a few as well if you want to buy some. So for about 100 years now, I've been hearing the question, what more can we possibly learn about the Black Sox scandal? And every once in a while, some of us return to a stage like this, and we say, well, about that, we've got something new. In the 21st century, we've discovered a few really cool resources like contract cards that are at the National Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, which have allowed us to find out player salaries from the 1919 season and compare them with other players. We've also discovered film footage of the 1919 World Series that was thought to have been lost forever. I believe a few of you were in Houston at the Sabre Convention to dissect a three-second clip over and over again of Game 1 of the 1919 World Series. We've also discovered partial transcripts of the 1920 grand jury and also the 1921 criminal trial. Those documents are now at the Chicago History Museum, and you can go see those as well. Today, we're excited to announce yet another big discovery and new information about the Black Sox scandal that probably will have some relevance in the 21st century, given sports gambling and the betting landscape today after the U.S. Supreme Court decision in 2018. You, of course, cannot watch a baseball game today without seeing ads for sports books and encouraging fans to bet on the game. So it is all still very, very relevant. And so we're going to talk a little bit about what happened 100 years ago and tie it in a little bit to what's going on today as well. So today we're excited to talk about our new book, which just was released last week by Eckhart's Press. It is Shoeless Joe Jackson versus the Chicago White Sox. First of all, show of hands real quick. How many of you have ever heard of this trial from 1924? All right.
Good
That's
showing.
That's a pretty good showing.
That's good showing.
I hope it's in part because of some of the work of our Sabre Black Sox Scandal Committee over the last few years. 10 years ago, Bill Lamb, a Bob Davids Award winner, published a book called Black Sox in the Courtroom. He was able to view a private copy of the trial transcript, which is now available for everyone else to see. But very few people, we estimate about 10 people on the planet, have ever seen this transcript before now. So we're going to talk a little bit about how this transcript came about, why we have a copy of it, and how this book came about for us to talk about today. So David, first of all, let's talk a little bit about this trial. What was it? How does it fit into the entire Black Sox story?
Sure, Jacob. I'm glad to see so many people out there are familiar with the story about the 1924 trial. This is the only trial where there was actually cross-examination under oath. The grand jury situation before was not that type of situation. The criminal trial, three of the players who had given confessions did testify, but that wasn't really under cross-examination. It was about the process of their given testimony to the grand jury. So this is the first time all the parties are under the oath and talking about the key incidents in the scandal. And so this is basically has the most accomplished player, the star player, Shoeless Joe Jackson. He had signed a three-year deal to play for the White Sox in February of 1920. And as everybody knows, he got suspended from the White Sox on September 20th, 1920, and didn't play in the 21 or 22 season, got banned for life. But he had a contract, and he wanted his back pay. And he got the interest of a firebrand attorney in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, who was also a baseball player named Raymond Cannon. Very colorful figure who went to law school at Marquette. And he played baseball himself as a pitcher, and he was friends with Happy Felch. And the reason why a Milwaukee-based attorney could sue the Chicago American Baseball Club was because the White Sox were corporate headquarters, or their charter was in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So they were not an Illinois corporation. They were after they got sued in these cases, but they had to go to, for this trial, had to be in Milwaukee. So it was a trial that really should never have happened. Comiskey should have settled this case beforehand. He did offer some, like $2,000 to go away. It didn't happen. And so this is the only really document in baseball history where so much is exposed from the front office about salaries, negotiations, and things like that. And so the fun thing about this transcript, and this is a big book, so if you buy one, you're going to get a hernia carrying it, is 330,000 words. It compiles 14, 16 days of worth of testimony altogether. It started in late January 24, went to Valentine's Day of 1924. It was national news, front page in the New York Times, heavily covered in Chicago. So it was a very, very prominent historic trial. So that gives you a little bit of background. And I think the significance is for the Black Sox committee, this is the final centennial celebration of the Black Sox scandal, because after 1924, except for that brief thing in 27 when you had about the White Sox paying the Tiger players incident come up, this is the last hurrah.
Yeah. We've spent 5 years celebrating the centennial anniversary of the Black Sox scandal. So this, I promise you, this will be the end of the centennial commemorations. Yeah. So let's back up a little bit and kind of put this into context as far as the Black Sox scandal itself, just to kind of give you a little bit of a timeline of, you know, where this all fits in. Obviously, the World Series happened in 1919. Cincinnati Reds beat the White Sox in 5-3. It was a best of nine back then. And that happened in 1919. And then, of course, another full season was played in 1920. And it wasn't until the end of the 1920 season when the Black Sox scandal was exposed. And that happened because there was a grand jury that was called in Chicago. And they were investigating, originally they were investigating a Cubs versus Phillies game, and then it kind of evolved into an investigation of the 1919 World Series. And so September 28th, 1920, Shoeless Joe Jackson and Eddie Seacott both testify and basically confess their involvement, and that was what really kind of broke it all open. And so in 1921, a criminal trial was held. They were all indicted on conspiracy charges. The eight ball players and also five gamblers were indicted. And so they were found not guilty by the jury, which then proceeded to celebrate with the Black Sox players at a restaurant on the west side of Chicago that was owned by an associate of Al Capone, because hey, it's still Chicago. Yeah. And then the very next day, Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis banned them all for life. And so they never played professional baseball again. So that was 1921. Well, the following season began, Black Sox players are gone, and in May of 1922 is when the Black Sox players basically hooked up with Ray Cannon in Milwaukee. Happy Felch filed the first lawsuit, and then Swede Risberg, Shoeless Joe Jackson, and Buck Weaver also filed suits. So four of the eight Black Sox filed breach of contract suits against the White Sox trying to get back pay. None of the other three went to trial, but Shoeless Joe's did. And this is a scene that is almost incomprehensible today. Imagine a star player in the major leagues today suing his former team and it actually going to trial. And, you know, players, owners, executives, all being forced to testify under oath. That would never happen today. Major League Baseball would not allow it, that, you know, it would get settled so quickly. And so the fact that this trial even exists is something that, you know, is out of the history books, really. And so the fact that we have a record of it, that a record that was long thought to be lost, is really incredible. And to have this out there and to be able to put this out and let other people, other researchers, see it and see the testimony and read it for yourself, It's just, you know, breathtaking to know that this type of record exists, this type of primary source documentation exists. And for a room full of researchers, you know, I know you can appreciate just having something like this out there is really incredible. So, David, I want to talk a little bit about how you first discovered this transcript and how you were able to find a copy of it yourself.
Sure. Great question. So I think everybody knows the late Gene Carney. He was we like to say the Bee Sox trail master. It's around the time I became friends with Jacob in the early 2000s. And so he was really following the trail on the Black Sox, thought there was a big cover-up. And he was aware about the trial in Milwaukee. But there was nothing out there. There was no literature about it. There was no information. A little bit had come out in the Grotman book about it, but it was not in any of the detail. There weren't transcripts available. There wasn't something in any of the historic trials that was there, even though this was a huge national story. It just didn't exist. There wasn't anything out there. So we had gotten the coverage from the New York Times, the Milwaukee papers, and it was very interesting in how it was covered. An interesting tidbit, at the same time Joe Jackson's on trial, Adolf Hitler's going to go on a trial a couple weeks later. we talk about in the companion book that we got coming out. But
the gravity of the crimes were a little different. Yeah.
But anyway, so we knew the only person in the world who had the transcript was the grandson of Ray Cannon. It was an attorney named Tom Cannon up in Milwaukee. And so Gene and I, we reached out to him. At the same time, I was becoming friends with Elliot Azanoff. And we had started having some suspicions about the accuracy of Eight Men Out based on the research we had done. So we really felt that going to Milwaukee was important. And Tom was wonderful. And I can remember picking up Gene at the airport, and you know, it was like he died and went to heaven. Hopefully he's here now. He was so excited when we got this box of all the transcripts, exhibits, pictures, and stuff like this. And he just meticulously took notes, and you know, so did I. But he really got it. And so that was sort of the foundation for his book, Burying the Black Sox. Originally, his title was going to be Never on a Friday. And so that Milwaukee trial was his first chapter, and that was sort of the whole push, what's led to this committee and all the discoveries we happened with this was the Milwaukee trial. And so, you know, he felt he got all this inside information. Well, we couldn't get a copy of it. Mr. Cannon was not going to allow us to take it out of the office. We took as many notes as possible. So later that fall, Gene and I hooked up with Elliot Azanoff and talked to him. Why didn't you go up to Milwaukee and look at this transcript if it was available? And because he was told by Judge Friend, who was one of the most biggest sources of his book, about that he could go up there and get that. But he didn't do that. So anyway, flash forward to 2007. I was working on this baseball museum project, and I got to be really close to Jerome Holtzman. And Jerome Holtzman absolutely loathed Joe Jackson. He thought Joe Jackson was as guilty as can be, and wrote a book, Baseball City Style or something like this, that came out and had about Jackson, and he was guilty. He made some kind of comment. I know he's illiterate, but he can certainly count when he talked about the 5,000. But so Jerome, when he wrote this book, he got a copy of the transcript. So Jerome's health is failing, and I'm looking to see a foundation collection for the museum project. And he's offering to sell all his books, papers, periodicals. He had every Sporting News, Sports Illustrated bound since like the mid-50s. Incredible collection. New York Times called it the best private collection of baseball in the world. So we ended up acquiring it for a very princely sum. In that collection was the transcript, the second copy that existed. And so people knew that I had gotten it, and I had allowed researchers to use it. In fact, Bill Lamb's book was the copy we had. And so I kept waiting to see if Mr. Cannon would do something with the transcript in the future to donate to the Hall of Fame or some other organization like Sabre. So finally, Jacob does a presentation in Springfield for historic trials to the Illinois Supreme Court at the Lincoln Museum. And I hook up with him and say, we got to do something. It's 1924, 100th anniversary is coming up. We got to put this transcript out. And so that was sort of the project. We basically started last October, you know, worked our fannies off to, you know, take the transcription from 7 big bound books and put it into the form we have now, and you know, clean up some of the, that we kept the typos in as far as the spellings, because Jackson had misspelled a lot of things from his dialect. We kept that in there. But so we just really felt this was something that had to come out to researchers. And it's really a fascinating read because it's like a movie script, because at the end, Joe Jackson's thrown in jail. I mean, that's the climax.
Spoiler alert.
What? So it's really good because it has all the main characters in there, from Bill Burns to Mereg to, you know, Comiskey, Harry Grabner. You know, it's got, you know, Eddie Seacott, Lefty Williams. And so it has all the main characters, has a story out there, and it's just a fascinating read because it just provides so much information. And I think one of the things I like the most is the fact that in the transcript, I call, you know, Alfred Austrian the Michael Cohn of the White Sox, the fixer, and he, they talked all about Burt Collier. They got information from Burt Collier, who the names were that were involved in the scandal. That never came out before. And so it is something, if you have an interest in the story, this will give you a whole new perspective. And you can just, you know, read one witness for a while. We've got it divided day by day. We've got the exhibits listed, all exhibits. We've got, 54 exhibits, something like that. We've got all the different attorneys and witness lists and stuff like that.
So let's talk about, speaking of Alfred Austrian, who is the White Sox Corporation Counsel and also the Cubs as well. It's really fascinating to read testimony from front office executives and also to see them be cross-examined and you know, ask questions by Shoeless Joe's lawyers as well. You know, those were pretty hostile you know, days on the witness stand. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, Charles Comiskey and Alfred Austrian and Harry Grabner, who was essentially the general manager of the White Sox. His title at the time was secretary. All three of them, three, you know, high-ranking White Sox officials, testified in this case. Can you talk a little bit about what they revealed and, you know, more about their team finances, team operations, and also the spying on the Black Sox players that they authorized?
All right. One of the other witnesses is the detective who, Hunter, who and his crew went out to California, went to Milwaukee, and never went to Savannah, Georgia, just basically try to uncover information about the finances of the Black Sox players that were involved and so forth, and including some of the stuff about Swede Risberg having a girlfriend and stuff like that, which was pretty salacious kind of stuff. But they just basically was treated like they were a corporation. They had dishonest players. They were protecting the brand. They wanted to investigate what was going on. And that was important to the White Sox. Theory that Ray Cannon had representing his client was the White Sox didn't have a case about not paying Joe Jackson because of the World Series scandal. They knew that he got the $5,000. And so they accepted that when they offered him a 3-year deal in February of 20 after the World Series had concluded. So Harry Grabner is a key character, and then going down doing his test, his how he got Joe to sign a contract. All of us know about Jackson, you know, was illiterate. Could he sign his name? Could he not? This gets such minutia where you have handwriting experts about his signature. So that, it gets into that. So, but I think some of the fascinating parts are the fact that the two court reporters who took the transcription for Lefty Williams and Joe Jackson's grand jury testimony talk. and they talk about, you know, how they recreated the testimony for the 21 criminal trial. And a big myth about Eight Men Out, especially in the movie, is that, you know, suddenly the grand jury testimony of Jackson appears out of George Hundle, who was the Comiskey attorney representing them, his briefcase. And that was far from the truth, because the 21 trial, they used the transcripts and it's part of the public record. So I think if you're interested in this, those are the things that are just fascinating, is how they did their investigation, what they uncovered, and you know, what they tried to do with it.
Yeah, you might remember, if you remember the movie Eight Men Out, you might remember the dramatic courtroom scene in which the White Sox lawyers bring out of their briefcase the what they called the stolen confessions of Shoeless Joe Jackson. And somehow this was supposed to have led to the acquittal of the players. This is, you know, supposedly, this is the myth, why they were acquitted in 1921, because the confessions were stolen, and then later on they reappeared. Well, it was this trial where they supposedly reappeared. But they were never lost in the first place, because, as David said, in the criminal trial, 1921, the transcripts were read right back into the record, and so it was always there all along. Shoeless Joe's lawyers all knew that the White Sox had a copy, and they could have had a copy too. They were just, you know, playing lawyer games. You know, these confessions were never stolen, and they never dramatically reappeared. Everybody knew it was actually, you know, kind of an essential part of this trial was, would they be admitted as evidence? Would those testimonies be admitted? And they were. And a big part of what you'll find in this book is the old grand jury testimony being read back to the Black Sox players, Eddie Seacott, Lefty Williams, and Shoeless Joe Jackson, and Happy Felsch. All had their old grand jury testimony reread to them, and they were asked about it. Did you make this answer, and did you answer truthfully? And unfortunately for Shoeless Joe and Happy Felsch, when they were confronted with their old testimony, which again was under oath, they both said, no, I never made that answer, I never said that, that's not true, and no, I didn't do it. I had nothing to do with the 1919 World Series scandal. Unfortunately, we know that is not the truth at all. And so that led to the dramatic conclusion of this trial. Let's talk first about the jury verdict, which came in favor of Shoeless Joe Jackson, and then what happened after that?
Well, the jury basically awarded him his back pay plus the bonus they were supposed to get for winning the 1917 pennant. But Judge Gregory, who was a huge baseball fan, he set aside the jury's verdict and, you know, basically said that Jackson perjured himself. So did Happy Felsch. And so because of that, he was thrown into jail. He had a warrant out for his arrest. He went back to Wisconsin. And so he didn't get his money. But, you know, Jackson would use this as vindication that a jury, you know, found I wasn't involved. And so this is the whole central theme of the transcript, is that Jackson didn't keep his story straight. And I bring up the issue, I think that Ray Cannon could have done a better job of preparing his client. He knew that they were going to talk to him about his grand jury. He needed to prep him about what he should respond to. And it's really sad when you read it. And I think some of you, Bill Lamb has written an article further on about what Joe Jackson said later in life, and I think some of you remember in 2010, Jacob did a great job with Furman Bisher, who did an interview with Jackson in the 40s, and he further changed the story, had a 5-year deal instead of a 3-year deal.
Yeah, you know, and if you read through some of this testimony, the lawyers were almost pleading with Shoeless Joe and with Happy Felsch, because they were confronted with not only their old testimony, but also their contracts with the White Sox. And Happy Felsch even denied that that was his signature on his own 1920 White Sox contract. And at one point, Ray Cannon says to Happy Felsch on the stand, you know, Happy, if that's your signature, just say so. And Happy still refused to admit anything. And so that was the reason, you know, again, he was cited with perjury. So again, kind of a dramatic conclusion to the trial. You know, Jackson and Phelps both spent some time in jail in Milwaukee before being bailed out, but you know, neither of them, none of the Black Sox really got any money from the White Sox in you know, any of these cases. So it was really kind of a sad end. This was, you know, really the end of all the legal proceedings. There was really not much after this in terms of, you know, courtroom drama. And if you've read Bill Lamb's book, you know, he explains and analyzes a lot of, you know, why this stuff happened. And part of the reason is because the players themselves, part of the reason this trial happened is because the players themselves had no other recourse whatsoever. There was no players union at the time, although Ray Cannon's son, Robert Cannon, would later help form the Major League Baseball Players Association. He was its first executive director in the 1950s. That was Robert Cannon. But you know, part of Robert Cannon's understanding of player rights is that, you know, one of the people that his father represented 30 years earlier, you know, had no recourse whatsoever. There was no one they could appeal to try to get back on the field. There was really, you know, no one they could appeal to in the court system either. You know, they tried for breach of contract, you know, which is pretty settled law, but, you know, they weren't able to really get anything that way either. So, you know, once Judge Landis said, "You're out," that was it. You know, they were gone. And that's obviously something that has changed a lot today. You know, a lot of people are very upset with how the Houston Astros World Series scandal was handled, and, you know, how Commissioner Rob Manfred dealt with the players by offering them immunity. You know, that's a word that has come up with the Black Sox before as well. And, you know, the commissioner back then, Judge Landis, did not, you know, have to do anything. He did not have to play ball. You know, there was no National Labor Relations Board in 1924. And so, you know, the players really had, you know, no other recourse to do anything. And so I think that's, you know, something that as you read through this transcript, if you do, you know, that's something to keep in mind, is that, you know, this was kind of a very desperate move by Shoeless Joe and by the other players to, you know, try to win back something. They weren't going to be able to get back on the field, so maybe they could get a little bit of money out of it. And obviously that didn't happen either. So, you know, David, as you went through the transcript, what did you find that, you know, kind of was enlightening from Shoeless Joe, from Charles Comiskey, from any of the other witnesses? What was it about reading through the transcript that, you know, maybe surprised you or that helped you learn some new things?
I think the Charles Comiskey testimony is really interesting because he admits about his 1890 Brotherhood involvement, you know, where it was a, you know, very the players' league they had, talking about it. I think that was very helpful. And I think also his opinion about Jackson as a ball player. I mean, I think what comes out of this this transcript is the expert witnesses for Jackson in making his case were two sports writers that said they didn't see anything that was unusual, and so that was their basis for saying he played, you know, excellent ball, .375 average, had a better World Series in 1919 than he did in 1917, and I think just basically hearing how, you know, Comiskey thought that he played fair and square in the game, and it sort of, that was sort of the thing that Jackson's legal team picked up on, was, hey, you didn't see anything that was nefarious, and, you know, I should get my money and so forth. So I think that Comiskey's testimony I really enjoyed. And then I think you'll enjoy the testimony from Billy Merrick, because that's been kind of lost to history. You know, he testified in the 21 criminal trial. That's still one of the holy grails, along with Harry Grabner's diary, that's still out there. The 21 trial, I think we got about 30 pages of the transcript. We don't have Merrick's testimony. So reading the testimony he gives, I think is very fascinating about the meetings with people, how they did things, and how informal it was. So this is the complete accounting, you know, four of the key players involved, the management, and then, you know, two key gamblers.
Yeah, you know, I think it's really fascinating to go through the witness list. We have a witness list in this book to, you know, explain what you're reading and you know, who's testifying. And it's really fascinating because you've got four of the Black Sox players out of the eight. You know, you've got three White Sox officials. You've got sports writers. You've got Shoeless Joe Jackson's wife. You've got a couple of the gamblers, you know, Billy Maharg and Sleepy Bill Burns. You've got the Chief Justice of the Chicago Criminal Courts in 1920, Charles McDonald. That's also interesting as well. And so, and the detective who was in charge of spying on the White Sox players in the offseason after the 1919 World Series. So there's just a lot of really interesting testimony from a lot of varied characters in this story. And I understand it's, you know, certainly hard to keep them all together, which is why we tried to put together some explainers in this book to help, you know, put it all into context. But it's really fascinating to read because, you know, they have to answer a lot of questions about their own backgrounds and their own actions, both in 1919 and, you know, also afterwards as well. And so it was very interesting to read through, again, Charles Comiskey's testimony, the other White Sox officials. You know, they weren't just talking about the Black Sox scandal. They were also talking about their own lives, their own careers, their own families in some cases. And so to be able to read through that and have that documentation and have it, you know, in print forever, and I think that's something that, you know, is really invaluable. So before we get to questions, we've got about 15 or 20 minutes left. Before we get to questions, let's talk a little bit about what you think is possibly the next, as you said, the holy grail of Black Sox documents that perhaps in another 3, 4, 5 years we might hopefully be here discussing today.
Well, my number one hit list would be Harry Grabner's diary. I think some of you know that I was friends with Fred Kriebel before he died, Bill Veeck's nephew and uncle. And anyway, I would just love to see that. I asked Mike Veeck yesterday when I saw him, you know, words of that. I've asked his family members, I've asked the Lynn family. Elliot Azanoff said he saw it once when they were doing that ESPN documentary in around 2000. Word is, would be fabulous. So I think that's a key document. And then I think the 21 criminal transcript, it's got to be someplace. And we've got scraps of it. So those are the two things I think that are out there that would add further to the story. If we could get some more grand jury testimony, we've got quite a bit of it at the Chicago History Museum. From folks, we'd love to see the whole transcript for Arnold Rothstein. So those are some things. But this is an important piece that brings it together. And we almost didn't have this transcript because the Milwaukee court system was going to throw this in the garbage. And it's got, believe it or not, it's got like 20 cash Joe Jackson paychecks, and a few of me actually signed. So they were throwing the garbage, and they asked Ray Cannon's son Robert, who became a judge and was starting the player pension before, back in the 50s, before Marvin Miller. He saved it for history. So, so I think if you have an interest in this, I think this will really be illuminating. It's a pretty fast read, despite the fact it's 330,000 words, and we broke it up in a very, I think, compact, easy to read way of how we organized it, because before the transcript was just transcript pages. It was around 1,700 pages. Didn't have any organization. You know, this is nice, especially you get the ebook. You can, you know, do word search and stuff like this. But it's something to savor because this is the complete story. This gives out more information about the history than any one source.
Excellent. So let's open it up for questions, and we'll talk about this trial, this book, or anything else related to the Black Sox scandal that you're interested in. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, earlier Leslie was talking about how we have to update our, anytime we find something's wrong, we have to be willing to admit our mistakes and move on, get past the myths. I recall you writing something, 8 Myths Out, which is kind of a good companion to this. I'm almost tempted to just throw out all these Black Sox books that I have. Would it make sense to just kind of go with Lamb's book and your book as two companion pieces and just ignore everything before that?
I don't know if you have to ignore everything before that, but you certainly have to put it all into context. And, you know, in part because authors like Elliot Asimov and Donald Grotman, you know, in the 1970s, you know, they just didn't have access to this information, you know, and I think that's something that's important to consider. It's, you know, and Grotman in particular, his biography of Shoeless Joe, which is called literally Shoeless Joe, you know, I think that's something, or Shoeless, I think that's, you know, a very valuable resource because he was able to talk to people who knew Jackson. And so he's got interviews, he's got primary sources that no one else was able to get in the 1970s, you know, but he's lacking in other areas. They didn't have the contract cards. They didn't have, you know, the grand jury testimony. They didn't certainly didn't have this trial transcript. So there are pieces to the puzzle that are interesting and valuable to put into context, but, you know, we've certainly learned a lot more. And my hope is that, you know, 40 years from now, and somebody's reading our work, there's a lot more new sources of information that said, well, you didn't quite get that right. That's okay. That's part of research. Yeah.
Could you speak for a moment if you've turned up anything about how the trial was covered and how it was received in Cincinnati and with the Reds, their players, their staff, and certainly their fans?
Well, I would say, you know, for this trial, it wasn't covered very heavily in Cincinnati at all. But the 1921 trial, you want to talk about
that? Yeah, I mean, it was covered in 1921. It was covered in Cincinnati. I think when it was Cincinnati, we did that in like 04 for Sabre. You know, there was, a lot of the players had a chip on their shoulder. You know, Reds players, you know, like their crown was tainted. So I did not see much evidence, any Cincinnati media interest in this. So good question, though. Yeah.
In general, the Reds players were very adamant for the rest of their lives that they would have beat the White Sox fair and square no matter what. So, and they very much had a talented team. So,
yeah, before the 1924 trial, several people were deposed, including Jackson, Williams, Seacott. Now, do we have transcripts of those other than the material that was introduced in trial? Do we have those full depositions?
Yes, all the depositions for this trial, whether they happened in 1923, 22.
Even if the material wasn't introduced in the trial, you still have all of it?
Let me answer that question. Yep. Some of it is in the book. So Jackson and, Jackson did a pre-trial deposition. They reference the transcript itself is actually still at Tom Cannon's office in Milwaukee. He has the actual transcript. We don't have that. In the chapter on Ed Seacott and Lefty Williams, they did not testify live at trial. They read their deposition transcripts. And in fact, Williams testified twice. And both of them are very defiant.
But we have those full transcripts.
They're right on complete.
Good.
Yeah, and so Merrigan and Bill Burns did not testify live. Those evidence transcripts were read.
Very good. Thank you.
But yeah, most of the witnesses who were deposed are included here.
One is not. It was Judge Landis. And, Judge Landis testified in this case, and I've not been able to find. I did not see that one 20 years ago when I was in Cannon's office. So
maybe it'll come up.
Yeah.
Maybe just a clarification question. So I heard you say that you didn't correct any of the spelling errors and that sort of thing in the transcript. And you said something about Joe Jackson's dialect. Is that more like they couldn't understand what he was saying and they probably got it wrong? Or was it the kind of the stylized, like, shoulda, coulda, stuff like that?
Yeah, so we corrected anything factual, you know, that was incorrect. And we also corrected the courtroom stenographer's errors. So they misspelled Lefty Williams in every single case. We corrected that. You know, just human error.
But
that's fine.
What's really, and Jacob really did a great job on this. I mean, he really deserves so much praise for this. It's easy for the reader to see when we did that because we have a parenthesis. Mm-hmm. We thought that this is an historic trial. This is the first time. You know, whatever baseball case, do you have the entire transcript? And it's such a historic. And so I think you'll like that. I'd love to have the feedback on that. But I think having that, I think it makes it easier to read. But we did not change some of the dialect of Jackson and his wife.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
You had mentioned, sorry, I'm short. You had mentioned that, thanks. You had mentioned that the other Black Sox did not go to trial, even though they sued. What happened to them? Did they settle?
They did not settle. It was essentially consolidated. Jackson's case was treated as, you know, essentially the case that if he had won, they probably would have pursued their lawsuits. You know, they were essentially dismissed after the Jackson verdict was set aside. So
give a little more on that question. Is Felch continued to pursue his case after he'd been thrown in jail for perjury against Comiskey, and it's in the summer of 24. And I'm going to write a lot more about this, and I know Bruce has talked about this, but Comiskey's health was not good during the 1919 World Series and also during the 1920s. And so after this trial, and the Felch trial is heating up, they're going to go to trial, they want to take Comiskey's deposition. And he's refusing to come to Wisconsin because he's ill. He ends up having some gallbladder. Ended up having gallbladder surgery. And so, well, my day job is I'm a physician. I do a lot of expert witness work and independent exams. And so Cannon was trying to get a judge's order to have Comiskey examined by a physician in Milwaukee to see if he could stand trial and stuff like that. So, but they ended up going away. I think I've seen the best figure that Jackson did finally settle for like $2,000. And I know in the Buck Weaver case, he did not use Ray Cannon as an attorney. He actually filed in Illinois court. And so the White Sox defense were Wisconsin Corporation. You can't do it in state court. And so his strategy was to go to federal court. And so he went to federal court. And actually, there's a great, Harry Grabner gives a really great affidavit in that case. But it did not go to trial. It did settle, though, before trial.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Well, now that you've reached this point in your research, how did your view of Joe Jackson change, and how do you feel about him now?
Well, you know, I would say I think originally, you know, I grew up reading Eight Men Out. I grew up believing, you know, oh, these guys got railroaded. And I think now I have a little bit more of a nuanced view of there's a lot of guilt all over the place. And there's a lot of blame to spread around, and certainly the players, accepted the bribe money. Most of them, you know, did something on the field to throw the World Series. Whether, you know, Shoeless Joe did or not, I think we'll still be debating for another 100 years. But, you know, he certainly took the money. I mean, there's just absolutely no question about that. He does admit that in his 1920 testimony that he was confronted with, which is in here. 1924, he's a little bit, he hedges a little bit. But his wife, Katie, also was deposed for this trial. And she not only admits, you know, that Joe accepted the money, she talks about what she did with it.
How she spent money.
And the bank cashier who deposited it in Savannah, Georgia, was also deposed in this case.
He's a witness.
For, you know, about an hour. Yeah. And so he talks about, you know, yes, she deposited this money after the 1919 World Series. So there's no question about it. He took the bribe money. And for a lot of people, that's it. That's the end of the story.
So we can put to bed any talk of him going
Absolutely.
Into the Hall of Fame at this
point.
And,
you know, if Bill Lamb were here, he wasn't able to travel to Chicago this week, but if he were here, former prosecutor, he would tell you probably a very different opinion, as a prosecutor. But my view, I think, is a little bit more nuanced. There's, you know, a lot of blame to go around. You have to look at the context of gambling in baseball in 1919. There were games being fixed. The Ty Cobb-Trespeaker scandal, you know, was in the fall of 1919, 1 week before the World Series began. There's a lot going on there. And I think you have to understand the context of gambling and baseball to understand, you know, why these guys did it, what happened, and, you know, how they were treated afterwards. Yeah.
So Charles McDonald, who's the judge that Austrian brought Jackson to before he went to the grand jury, testifies in this case. And he says that Jackson told him he didn't play as hard as he could. And obviously Jackson contradicts it, but that's, you know, as a firsthand witness, I know it's somewhat hearsay, but at the same time it was a statement that he gave. So I have a lawyer shaking, telling me I'm wrong in front of me. All right, so I'm glad I'm the layperson here, but I think you'll find that, and I think it's sad. It gives, especially, I think there's sadness with Seacott and Williams because they just basically shut down. You know, their lives are over with this, and It's very, very dramatic. I mean, it really is. It's not a dry transcript. It's got a lot of drama, a lot of fireworks.
And, you know, part of this is why we had Bill Lamb read this before it was printed, and a few other attorneys as well, just to make sure, you know, all the legal stuff was correct. So,
yes, I'm interested in the Alfred Austrian issue, and that just as a way of an introduction, I have done conflict of interest training. I've done investigations. Also come from Canada, so maybe my concepts might be different from what they are in Illinois and Wisconsin. But I've had talks with Bill Lamb about this, and he and I respectfully disagree with each other. I think Alfred Austrian was in a blatant conflict of interest at the beginning because, as Bill Lamb correctly says, he's an employee of the White Sox. His job is to represent the White Sox organization. He knew or should have known that players who don't have a lot of education might not realize that you have independent legal counsel. So for him to take that action and take it to the courts, I think is a blatant conflict of interest. But I know Mr. Lamb doesn't agree with me at all on that point, but he would be interested from the book there what perspective you may have on this.
Well, I would love to see you make that case in a future Black Sox newsletter or the Baseball Research Journal. And, you know, one of the reasons we wanted to get this out there is for people, you know, with that expertise and with that type of background to be able to read this and you know, form your own opinions about Shoeless Joe. Yeah. Some people are going to read this and say, oh, yeah, this makes Shoeless Joe look even more guilty, you know, because, again, he was confronted with the 1920 testimony. But, you know, you might pick up on other things, too. And I think that's, you know, one of the big reasons why we wanted to get this out there is so that other people, you know, could see this and use this as, you know, the basis of future research.
So how about my next research project?
There you go.
Hey, great question. In 21 trial, there's 5 pages of Jackson's testimony. I don't know if people have seen that. He actually admits that Alfred Austrian told him to get his own attorney. It's in the transcript of that. And so it kind of shoots that argument about conflict of interest. He was given, and he didn't even, you know, some of the legal experts, and I'm not checked with Mr. Berlinger yet about this question, is that Austrian didn't have a duty to that. He was there to protect his client. He didn't have to do a Miranda type of warning to a dishonest employee, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
And we'd love to have some more input because we have a companion book, A Legal Analysis of the Trial in the Works.
Jacob, you just brought this up, and Dave, we talked about this the other day. Is there one other thing that probably, I mean, a lot of the research has been focused on gambling in this particular World Series, but we think there's a lot of other things that were thrown or compromised during that time frame leading up to that. I mean, gambling took place notoriously directly in stadiums. Are there some leads in here, or should this committee kind of foster an idea that we need to look beyond just the Black Sox and see what, before some of this other stuff might disappear into history, if there are some other things there? So in part, since you all have been through this, are there any leads in here that you think some of us should be following up on?
I would say not so much on that particular subject in this transcript, but if we ever get a hold of the full 1920 grand jury hearings, I think there's going to be a ton of stuff because they talked to John McGraw and half of the New York Giants, 8 of whom later basically got thrown out of baseball after the 1919 season. Not all for game fixing and gambling, but you know, they had testimony for 3 or 4 weeks.
Yes.
About gambling and game fixing in baseball. And so I think, you know, trying to further research on that subject, you know, we need to get a hold of those grand jury transcripts and, you know, maybe one day.
I agree with that because I don't think we know enough about how much Hal Chase was involved in the 1919 World Series. And you look at some of the little tidbits we got in the grand jury, it's all over. His fingerprints, he had a lot of engineering to do it. You read this, he's in this with Billy Merrick's testimony, talks about Hal Chase. I think everybody knows that the Cicotte grand jury does not exist completely, though he is confronted with it, so you pretty much hear it. The first thing he talks about, they got the idea from the Cubs. So I think that whole investigation, and that's why in Harry Grabner's diary, he talks about, was it Packer? Who's the Cubs fixer? The 1918, or pull out, I forget the name, but, you know.
Gene Packard.
Gene Packard. I mean, and so I think those are leads. Obviously, this is not the first original sin in baseball. But it's obviously, you know, you have a superstar that's the third best batter in batting average and who's out of the game, who's a, you know, become a mythological character, iconic on. So that's what makes this such a special, you know, book to read that, because this really gives his personality. He testifies 4 days in this case, and so does Comiskey. So you got the two main characters, are, you know, 8 total days on the stand.
All right, 2 more questions. Go ahead.
As you read the transcript, was there anything you said, why didn't he ask this question?
Oh, all the time.
Okay, and can you give some examples?
Yeah, no, there. I think the lawyers' performances in this case, you know, obviously the White Sox counsel did a lot better and had a more successful trial, but yeah, there were a lot of situations where you would, you know, Ray Cannon, you know, was very, very passionate, and you know, he very much wanted to defend Shoeless Joe, but. He also had a little bit of an attack dog mentality, especially when he was confronting Charles Comiskey, and he was cross-examining, you know, some of the other White Sox officials. And so, you know, rather than stay on topic and try to get them, you know, to debate some of the finer legal points in order to, you know, win the case for his client, you know, he was going after Charles Comiskey for, you know, things like the 1890 Players League and Comiskey's actions with the Brotherhood. That doesn't have any relevance whatsoever to a breach of contract suit in 1924, but Cannon, again, having, you know, kind of this early vision of players' union, you know, which his son then ran with, you know, he's trying to get Comiskey on that point, spending time on those types of questions and Comiskey's playing career and things like that, you know. So there were a lot of situations where you're reading, especially with Ray Cannon's arguments, it's like, why did you go there? You know, that wasn't really, there wasn't really much of a purpose in terms of a strategy, a legal strategy. But it does make for some entertaining reading. And Comiskey, you know, had a little bit of a temper, and he and Cannon sparred quite a bit during some of these exchanges. So it is definitely some entertaining reading. So, all right, final question.
Dan. I apologize for coming late. I was in the judge's meeting. I really feel badly
that's
about
that. That's timely. Thank you.
The question I have, you may have already taken this up, is in the course of preparing this book, which I'm going to have to get, did you come to any new conclusions about Chick Gandel?
Gandel wasn't mentioned too much in this particular case. There were instances in Lefty Williams and Eddie Seacott's depositions in which they talked about Chick Gandel approaching them. But, you know, I don't know that there's anybody on the planet that believes that Chick Gandel is not guilty. So, you know, I think it solidifies most people's opinions of Chick Gandel. But that was really the only times that Gandel was referenced, was when Williams and Seacott were talking about, you know, their actions with Gandel.
Was he part of the suit?
No.
No, not at
so
all.
So he basically, you know, he didn't sue for his money. He did. He
well, he didn't even play in 1920.
Well, I know that, yeah. But he was...
he didn't have a contract.
He didn't have a contract, so he had nothing. Right. He had no case.
And he had at least $35,000 from the World Series he lived on. So.
And it made him a happy man.
He did pretty good.
All right. I think that's about it. We've got another committee meeting here, so thank you all for your time. David and I will be heading over to the exhibitors room for a half hour. Thank you.